Yeah, so Lars actually asked me to give a historical perspective followed by whatever I thought were the interesting puzzles, so I will attempt to follow this. And I think the thing that's depressing about this is when you're asked to give the historical perspective, you realize that most of the action for the last 45 years has been down the hall from me in various places, so. Yeah, so this began, you know, sort of around the time I was learning to talk, but the end parts were down the hall from me. So in 1961, Joe Weber wrote his famous textbook on general relativity and gravitational waves, outlining the methods for producing them astrophysically and for detecting them on the Earth. In 1968, he claimed detections from two bars separated by 1,000 kilometers in coincidence. A couple of years later, he found sidereal periodicity. They happened when the galactic center was overhead. The bursts were impressive. It required about 10 to the 4 bursts per year at the distance of the galactic center, with 10 to the 53 ergs per burst. So that's roughly 300 solar mass black holes colliding every day in the Milky Way. So there was a lot of theoretical action, but I would say no astrophysically plausible theoretical action. But fortunately, over the 1972 to 1978, Braginsky, Drever, Garwin, Tyson, same one of LSST, Imaldi, and so on, built even better bars and failed to reproduce anything. I just thought it was rather amusing that the first electromagnetic GW searches for coincident electromagnetic events with these bursts were undertaken by Bruce Partridge, Schuster and Tyson, Dubay, and so on in 1972, 1973. So EMGW has a long history. No bursts were discovered in coincidence with these, but. Okay, so compact binary stars as gravitational wave sources actually began over lunch at the Athenaeum at Caltech. So Bob Kraft and Jesse Greenstein were trying to figure out what was going on with this repeating nova, which had outbursts in 1913 and 1956. And they discovered it had an orbital period of 81 minutes, which was unprecedented in those days. And they sat down next to John Matthews, who'd taken over from Feynman teaching, and Robertson teaching the general relativity class. And he pointed out that close double stars may radiate enough gravitationally power to be astrophysically significant and even detectable. So in the paper, they looked up, you know, Landau and Lifshitz gave the famous formula. He calculated the merger time scale, 5 over 256 will be familiar to all of you, I imagine, and said that, you know, they pointed out that the gravitational luminosity of this nova system was actually probably larger than the white dwarf luminosity. But they did remark that detection of such a small flux appears to be very difficult. So that was also prescient, 1962. But they also pointed out, the Matthews pointed out, that you might consider the change in the period of the binary, the rate of change of the period due to gravitational radiation gave a P dot, then in 15 years would be 60 seconds. And that was also prescient. That was how we first discovered gravitational wave reaction. But of course, the first thing he did is, after thinking about this and realizing that binaries and gravitational waves are interesting, he got a good graduate student to work out the details. So Peters and Matthews the next year have the famous papers that you all probably use, working out the amplitudes and the two polarization of gravitational waves and the averaged powers for eccentric case and the merger time scale and the eccentric case and so on. So that was all worked out shortly after that Athenaeum conversation. You notice it's pretty impressive, actually. It was 8 January 1963. So. So it's then interesting that now, if we look in 1972, the first big review article in Annual Reviews of Astronomy and Astrophysics on gravitational wave astronomy by Bill Press and Kip Thorne, they sort of have lists of typical sources, and, you know, they're the supermassive black holes, and pulsars were the main source in the 0.1 to 100 hertz, you know, mountains on pulsars and asymmetric pulsars and so on. And then at above 100 hertz, there were, you know, collapse of stars, asymmetric supernovae. I don't know what a Weber burst is, but whatever they were. but you notice that there are no binary stars in this thing, right? So the binary stars hadn't really percolated into gravitational waves. And most of the discussion was on bar detectors. They did have a line on laser interferometer, not yet used in gravitational waves. But measurable strains may well improve in the next decade. So they're predicting by 1982, H of 10 to the minus 20 will be achieved. So this is Kip's optimism that kept him going with LIGO for 40 years. Okay, so 1972, around the same time as that review article was published, Ray Weiss wrote his famous Progress Report number 105 of the MIT Research Laboratory for Electronics, in which he had a diagram that will be familiar to most of you, with some mirrors and a beam splitter and a laser. So his version, was actually somewhat different than the current one. That was really due to Ron Drieber's ideas of having a Fabry-Perot. The first actual implementation of this was by Robert L. Forward of the Hughes Aircraft Company. And just for light, in case you don't know, Robert Forward, who made the first interferometer, is also a famous science fiction book author, and I highly recommend The Dragon's Egg if you're interested in other great things that might be happening on the surfaces of neutron stars, namely very small life forms evolving on timescales of minutes to tremendous technological advancements and so on the surfaces of neutron stars. Again, around the same period as this, Estabrook and Walquist pointed out you could detect gravitational waves by Doppler tracking of spacecraft, and that and Ray Weiss and Peter Bender then immediately turned into LISA, what we now call LISA. Okay, so this has already been mentioned. Latimer and Schramm pointed out that black hole neutron star collisions could liberate a lot of neutron-rich material and produce the R process. But the binary business really, so this was again down the hall from me. This was down the hall from me when I was in high school. But 1975, Holtz and Taylor found their first binary neutron star system. And shortly thereafter, Clark and Eardley tried to put some numbers together to work out how many of these might happen, and they got 100 every 100 years at 15 megaparsecs. So if you scale that as d cubed, that's 3 per year at 100 megaparsec. I will just point out they have two canceling errors of a factor of 1,000, which allowed them to get the right answer. They assumed that the neutron star in this one had a life, like was a young neutron star with a lifetime of 10 to the 6 years, which gave them a rate 1,000 times too high, but they scaled their Milky Way mass wrong by a factor of 1,000, so they ended up with the correct answer, but anyway. So in this paper, they go through calculating the gravitational wave amplitudes, but once again, there's little ample room for stripping some neutron-rich material. We haven't calculated how much, but 0.1 solar mass seems reasonable, with interesting implications for the R process. And this is a little timeline. I'll jump back and forth a bit. So 1975 was the infamous time when Kip and Ray Weiss were stuck in the same hotel room in Washington for a NASA review, and they started talking about interferometers and decided that LIGO, something like LIGO, seemed like a good idea. And then for 10 years, they had individual grants, Weiss at MIT and Drieber and Thorne at Caltech, sort of developing ideas for this. And finally, in 1987, there was great battles going on. It was decided that one needed a professional to manage this, so Robbie Vogt took over as the Caltech MIT LIGO director and shepherded together a proposal to the NSF for the 4-kilometer LIGO with Robbie Vogt as PI. In 1990, the NSB and the NSF approved funding for LIGO construction subject to a proper phase A design study and so on. And this was, at that time, $250 million, and the astronomical community immediately went up in arms and said, gravitational waves have a history of being total bullshit. This is never going to work. This is a waste of money. We need more optical telescopes. So I got to experience vicious attacks everywhere I went to give colloquia on why Caltech was wasting the NSF's good money that could be given to real telescopes doing real science instead of this gravitational nonsense.
Was it also memory used as a counter argument?
Memory didn't come in until about 1995, I started getting the memory arguments, but yeah, that was why don't you just look for memory? Then in 1994, Barry Barish became the LIGO director. The NSF had been holding off money on construction because they didn't trust the team, but they trusted Barry, and LIGO construction actually started. Okay, so I just thought I'd show you the actual LIGO proposal. This is the proposal to the NSF by Robbie Vogt, Ron Drever, Kip, Fred Robb, and Ray Weiss at MIT for a 4-kilometer laser interferometer. These were the projected sensitivity curves for the early LIGO and a later advanced one. I noticed that this one, advanced one, has 1-ton mirrors, so there's clearly some further development needed. had a 60-watt laser, but 1-ton fused silicon mirrors. And so I guess the first thing to notice is, the curves are pretty much like all the same stuff you see over and over and over in LIGO talks already worked out. The one thing to notice is the seismic noise in early LIGO was not catastrophic at 50 hertz, but more like at 25 or something. So the Virgo suspensions were a big deal. And this is in the appendix to the NSF proposal, which basically has a giant preprint from Kip Thorne sort of trying to say what LIGO could see. And here you see, finally, there are neutron star coalescences. So in 1989, there are neutron star coalescences at 10 megaparsecs and black holes at 100 and so on. And there are three plots like this. So this is the one with binaries. There's another one with the more reliable continuous sources. These were sort of astrophysical prayers, but the really reliable ones that LIGO was certain to see were the low mass X-ray binaries and mountains on pulsars that would be nice continuous sources. So again, clearly further work is necessary. And then there was this another one with stochastic backgrounds from primordial black holes and cosmic strings and so on. But this was the first one, so easy to calculate, but unknown astrophysically then at some point. So my attempt to try to calm the astronomical community was inspired by the discovery of two more binary neutron star systems in 1991. So I wrote a little paper sort of working out extremely conservative, very conservative, and absolute upper limits to the rates. And introduced the 1/Vmax to this business, the Milky Way scalings, the total lifetimes, and so on, that sort of has been now done thousands of times later to get a rate. So currently, at that time, there were just these three double neutron star systems. There are currently 12 systems with 13 pulsars, right? There's one of them which formerly had two pulsars. For this decade, it only has one, but it will probably have two in the next decade. There are a couple of young unrecycled ones, 6 recycled ones for a total of 8 pulsars, 7 systems that will merge in less than a Hubble time, and then a whole bunch of long-lived systems with long orbital periods and merger times of 10 to the 11 or 10 to the 12 years. So in 1986, Paczynski proposed that gamma ray bursts were cosmological rather than galactic or near solar system even. That was heresy. There's a little sentence in it which says neutron stars might have something to do with this, but it doesn't say binary neutron stars or anything. So this was clearly a great discovery. The advantage of putting two ideas in one paper, disadvantage of putting two ideas in one paper, is sometimes people might laugh, right? This is the 1979 giant gamma ray burst he proposes is due to lensing of a cosmological one. But of course, we now know that's the SGR and the LMC, which is maybe cosmological, but certainly not gravitationally lensed. And 1989, there's this remarkable paper that finally puts together neutron star mergers, gravitational waves, the R process, and gamma ray bursts all together. By Eichler, Livio, Biron, and Schramm, pointing out that the neutron star mergers will produce R process, checking that it will produce them, produce gamma rays, gamma ray bursts, and so on. So this is when basically the topic of this conference got put together more or less all in one single 2-page paper. And then the beginning of the transient is Lee and Paczynski sort of considering radioactive heating. Of course, they didn't have the R process in, and the opacities were all wrong. So they got one day, that was pretty good. They got 10 to the 44 ergs a second. Maybe that one wasn't so good. But anyway, that was the beginning of the transient. Okay, so that was, I stopped my history at 2000. Okay, enough of you were young enough to remember some of the 2000 history, so I'll stop there. And you know, of course, you know, we've heard lots of Elliot and Brian Metzger and Dan working out proper details and really predicting better, much better than Lee and Paczynski what we actually saw. Okay, so of sort of interesting questions that have been bothering me, I think one thing, you know, it's nice when you discover the first object and it looks just like the theoretical predictions. The assumption is that everything after that will also look just like this one and just like the theoretical predictions. But in astrophysics, I think the warning is usually that there are a lot of parameters and things vary them and they don't all look the same. You know, there's viewing angle, for example. There's clearly one obvious one. And, you know, this one bothers me a little bit. So, you know, many people have pointed out that near the flux limit, 30 degrees is actually about the most probable inclination angle to see, because near face-on is brighter gravitational wave sources, so you can see them to larger distances. So that would be true if this were a marginal detection. But 30 degrees is not the most probable inclination at 40 megaparsecs with a signal-to-noise of larger than 20. So, you know, it's a little bit odd, but certainly I think we should expect that in the future, especially if they're high rates and a lot of them are nearby, that they won't all be at 30 degrees, and there should be some which are just red if they're viewed from the edges. If there are enough of them, of course, we might hope to see an SGRB. I'll get to that in a bit later. I'll talk a little bit more about the total mass. I think, you know, the observed neutron star systems, as I'll point out, are sort of just on the hairy edge where the final state might be a stable neutron star, a short-lived neutron star, or a black hole. And so I think we should be prepared for all three possibilities to occur in nature. It's not that unless the maximum mass is really remarkably low, I think probably all of these will happen. And you might wonder whether the black hole neutron star masses and therefore the final remnant just change by a couple tenths with the function of metallicity or age, and you might have dramatic dependences on the delay time, or one type might preferentially occur in elliptical galaxies with old populations and another type preferentially in starburst galaxies, and you just have to change the neutron star masses by 0.1 and you might completely change the final state and the appearance of the object. So I think we should be prepared for interesting population correlations of things. Now, sort of related to this is how much mass is left over on the outside, ejected and falling back, which might influence the jet power. And as we've seen, lots of vigorous discussion, there's possibilities that the jet might escape, it might not escape, it might not be present. And if it escapes, whether it's directed in some other direction and we can see late time radio evidence for its presence, or whether we can confirm that in fact some of these objects do not have any SGRBs associated with them, no matter which direction we were looking at them from. Of course, this one had gamma rays, and of course there's a great battle going on. Is this the edge of an SGRB, or is it something completely unrelated to a GRB? And I think this is worth thinking about more, that the gamma ray telescopes in some sense are so sensitive that just a tiny fraction of the mass and a little bit of a shock produce, has lots of other ways of producing gamma rays besides the traditional ultra-relativistic shock followed by, you know, synchrotron and inverse Compton and so on. So I think it's worth thinking about whether, you know, other ways of producing the gamma rays, some of which have been talked about publicly, some talked about privately, some not talked about at all, and lots of interesting ways. And likewise with the early blue emission, you know, there's free neutrons or shock breakout, lots of other possibilities for getting early blue, which we may or may not see in the later. And then finally, I mentioned the diversity of hosts. Okay, so let me discuss this question of the neutron star masses. So this is the list of the neutron star, binary neutron star systems with pulsars that we know exist in the Milky Way with their measured, well-measured masses. And this, adopting a sort of typical equation of state with a radius of around 12 kilometers, is the mass of the merged neutron star if it had any quite. So these would all, with this radius, these would all be stable neutron stars. And of course, the mass is not the sum of these two, which is the sum of those two minus the difference in the binding energy between the heavy one and the sum of the binding energy of the two light ones. So you can see that they're all sort of in the range of 2.1 to 2.3 solar masses is the observed system, right? There's one that would end up at 2.11, one at 2.3, so on. So it really matters a lot whether the maximum mass that we know extremely reliably to three significant figures is 2.04 solar masses. There is a neutron star and a pulsar with 2.04 solar masses. There are less reliably measured ones with masses of 2.4 solar masses and above. There are prospects that within 6 months that 2.4 may get many more significant figures, I hope. But so somewhere, currently somewhere, it's at least 2.04 and maybe 2.4, but 2.4 has big errors, so maybe it will turn out to be 2.1 or 2.3. But if the maximum mass is sort of in this range between 2.1 and 2.3, basically some of these will end up as stable neutron stars and some will end up as black holes, so we better be prepared for both. If the maximum mass is actually 2.4, then all of these will end up as massive neutron stars, and the models of this event, which really would like it to have a very short-lived neutron star, will have to work much harder, I would say. So there are lots of, I think, interesting future in this. And of course, it's maybe worth saying that these are the systems that have observed pulsars that were formed in the Milky Way with, and they're mostly fairly young, so the masses might have selection effects that depend on metallicity or something, and so maybe the ones we're seeing might have different masses. That's also to be worried about. Okay, so I think I've said all of that. Okay. So this is just sort of a graphical version showing the masses of neutron stars with white dwarf, with neutron star companions and then with white dwarf companions. And here's the 2.04. And the question is, you know, every year there's a new one and it goes up and we just need to keep waiting and measuring some of these guys more precisely. And probably there'll be some more points out here. And this may be a quicker way to nail equations of state than waiting for measuring tiny little values of tidal coupling in LIGO. If you find a 2.5 solar mass neutron star, I think most of those EOS diagrams are basically gone. When I was young in 1995, everybody knew that the maximum neutron star mass was 1.6 solar masses because they were guaranteed to be K on condensates that would make a soft equation of state, right? And then these damn pulsar astronomers just wiped out that whole field of particle physics. So, okay. Now, in the last few minutes, let me turn to this, something that's been bothering me about the rate problem. So the host galaxy for this source is, as we've heard, an old S0 galaxy. The neutron star merger rate is really dominated by short delay time systems. So most of the rate comes from systems with total lifetimes of sort of half a gigayear to a gigayear. There's one system with 2.5 gigayears. But they're all systems which would have formed in the last few billion years, and most of the rate's dominated by systems with less than a gigayear. And those rates that you infer from pulsars and from population synthesis, sort of, I would say, reasonable population synthesis, it's very hard to get a rate as high as one infers from this one object. Okay. Now, there are lots of ways that you could get a higher rate, one of which I first proposed back in 1991, that if you have a helium star, a low-mass helium star, it undergoes a helium-red giant phase, which leads to a second spiral end that produces systems with initial orbital periods of 10 minutes that merge in 10 to the 5 years. The expected number visible in the Milky Way is zero, and that could produce 99% of the birth rate. So you can have none of them in the visible as pulsars, but they can produce a huge birth rate, and there have been lots of papers expounding upon this since then. But of course, those all merge in 10 to the 5 years, so they only happen in a starburst galaxy, not in NGC 4993. Now, the long delay time systems in pulsar-derived models and reasonable population synthesis end up with a very low birth rate, and there's even a worse problem, which I will mention in a minute, which is that traditionally people scale, based again on my historical accident, to blue luminosity. You could also scale to star formation rates, but neither of those is relevant to the old systems. For the old systems, you should scale by stellar mass or something, or infrared light. And the Milky Way is actually quite faint in those and kind of low mass relative to the blue light and the star formation rate. So the normalization goes down by another factor of 3. So there's really, I would say, a factor of 30 to 100 tension in the rates for these old systems. So it's easy to get the high rate. It's just this is the wrong galaxy to have the high rate. That's the point I'm trying to make, right? So, you know, if these systems should, in a reasonable astrophysical world as we currently understand, both with pulsars and population synthesis, this type of galaxy should be producing about 1% of the neutron star mergers, not the first one. So, if, you know, 1% things happen, but maybe you should get a little worried. But the one way out is that unless these old systems have a very low or zero pulsar radio luminosity, in which case the Milky Way could be full of old radio quiet double neutron star systems that we wouldn't investigate by, we wouldn't discover by pulsar searches, and that population synthesis people who tune their models to agree with population, with pulsar discovery should not find, right? Okay, so there's a recent paper that came out a few days ago by Belchinsky et al., who recognized that there was a rate problem, perhaps amazing for those authors. I shouldn't have said that. This is being recorded, isn't it? But they do point out that you could maybe fix this a little bit by having homogeneous evolution of the same sort that was proposed for making the massive black hole systems that LIGO found. Close tidally locked binaries where you basically mix so the whole star is helium, doesn't undergo a red giant, and so you can make a short period main sequence system into a short period neutron star or black hole system. But this would occur mainly for low metallicity. So this is now interesting. So there are no young ones in the Milky Way because it only happens for low metallicity. So it allows a high merger rate in old systems without violating the pulsars and all the usual solar metallicity population synthesis. And it occurred to me that this could also be the thing you want to explain if it were real, this drop in the EU to FE ratio with FE over FH. If you have a huge burst early on that produces lots of these mergers, and then at once the Milky Way population is above 0.1, then you don't make any more. It's the right sense for that trend. So maybe there's some evidence for this, I don't know. So here's another little piece of evidence for it. So this is a diagram from my 1991 paper. It had 3 objects I put on, the 3 new ones. And this basically shows the pulsar age divided by the pulsar age plus the time to merge. So if P over 2 P dot were a reliable estimate of the age, which is probably really more like an upper limit to it rather than total, then you'd expect objects randomly selected to be uniformly distributed along this axis. Now, if you had a flux-limited sample and the objects are fading as they get older, then there's a preference for finding them when they're young and bright. But as you keep finding more and more and more of them, eventually you're 1 over V over V max, you shouldn't actually be doing any luminosity corrections. So eventually they should smear out over this diagram, unless they actually fade to 0 luminosity, in which case they never appear in your sample. And so I would say we now have 6 objects of which the maximum in this number is 0.4. And so maybe it's time to start thinking that maybe some of them are actually fading to invisibility rather than just fading to get faint. And so you find lots of them nearby, which would be the sort of simple fading model. So maybe, you know, very weakly from the our process elements to iron from this concentration, maybe there's some evidence that there might have been an early population of these merging objects that formed and faded so they're no longer detectable as pulsars. Okay, so here's just the point I mentioned about there's a, you know, how you do the scaling matters at the factor of 3 level. If you scale by star formation to the Milky Way, the blue light and the stellar mass, there's a factor of 3 even already in just how you do the Milky Way scaling. And I just thought I'd end by saying that, you know, neutron star and neutron star mergers are fun. There's hundreds of papers on them. White dwarf neutron stars are occurring at a higher rate in the universe than the neutron star mergers. And there's just like this many papers on them. So there's a real opportunity, I think, for theorists to consider. And there's a whole range, right? There's this one, which is known to be a white dwarf because we can see the white dwarf in the optical and it's 1.3 solar masses with a 1.3 solar mass neutron star. So when you see 1.3 white 1.3, you should not assume that it's guaranteed to be a neutron star. And this one, for example, which is beautifully measured, unfortunately, it's behind 40 magnitudes of extinction, and we don't know whether it's a white dwarf or a neutron star. It's pretty low eccentricity. And you know, here's the one solar mass. There was a Sloan source discovered where the white dwarf is about 0.9 solar masses, and the other object is something like at least 1.6, but it's not a pulsar, but we just see it as a single line spectroscopic binary. It's only 50 parsecs away, so these things have a huge rate. The merger rate is probably about 10 times the neutron star merger rate. And of course, you can do helium white dwarfs, you can do CO white dwarfs, you can do oxygen neon magnesium white dwarfs. There's all kinds of fun stuff. You can make planets out of them from the disk. You can make Thorne-Zhitkov objects. You can make calcium-rich transients if you drop the helium. So anyway, lots of fun. And these will be, you know, great LISA sources, maybe not LIGO, but okay.
Questions, discussion?
I have one just to make sure I understood the argument. So pulsars, we know, do fade as they spin down. They reach the death line. Is the issue that the ones in binary systems tend to be low field and that time scale is extremely long? So you need something on top of the usual.
Yeah, so let's see. So let's see, what was this diagram? Yeah. So this system, which might possibly be a white dwarf system, but it's 1.3 plus 1.3, this was the only one with a young pulsar in it. So this one actually has a sort of traditional high field, high spin, slow spin, young pulsar with a spin down age of 10 to the 5 years. The merger time is several 10 to the 8. So this one, this point here is actually, I pointed out, is at 0.0004, right? So for finding, this one has, will have, by the time this spins down, this one will be invisible for the next 400 million years. But all of these other ones are recycled pulsars for which clearly they can keep shining for giga years, and these are all less than a giga year old. So I think there's not naively expected for these observed systems to be much luminosity evolution. There would be for this one. And for the 0737, I mean, that one you have two chances to find it, of course. And one chance is short-lived and the other is long-lived. But
is this diagram a little bit biased by the fact that it's harder to do acceleration searches in order to find this short time scale for merger or system?
Yeah, so I think, you know, a lot of the data has actually been reanalyzed with acceleration searches. So I think anything with orbital periods less than about 1.5 hours, I think are probably now, you know, maybe the volume is not quite this full volume, but it's a good fraction of the search volume. If there were systems with merger times of 10 to the 5 years, those we wouldn't have found, but we don't expect to have any in the Milky Way because their lifetime is so short. So I think for systems for which the number in the Milky Way is reasonable, I think we actually have covered the merger times down to an order of several 10 to the 7 years, 10 to the 8 years is pretty well covered. But acceleration searches, there's an interesting area at the edge for acceleration searches, maybe especially for globular clusters.
Any other thoughts, questions, discussion? All right, let's thank Sterl again.